Midwest Title Loans v. Mills. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. States have more leeway to protect citizens from predatory lending than they do to protect businesses from external competition. That's the fundamental principle that we're seeking to vindicate in this case by urging the Court to apply only Pike balancing.
Well, how far would you push this? So suppose Indiana decided it had a problem with obesity of its population. So it decided to have a law that said no Hoosier can eat at a McDonald's anywhere in the world.
Yeah, no, I don't think we could do that. That's
why.
Well, I think for probably more fundamental reasons than simply Commerce Clause, which is to say due process.
No, we're just talking about the Commerce Clause.
Well, but it's important not to ignore that there are, I think.
I want to ignore those.
All right, fine. I think Commerce Clause-wise, what we don't have in that case is the same kind of state interest, because there isn't as much, there isn't any activity in that hypothetical necessarily occurring in the state except for the continued residency.
Obese people, and you know, and their medical costs are higher, and that's an expense for Medicaid, which is paid for usually 50% by the state. So you can make an argument.
Well, yes, and that's what Pike balancing is for.
Your people.
That's what Pike balancing is for.
But the problem is, you know, where are you going to stop? You're going to say, well, what about saying that no Hoosier can go to a casino in Las Vegas? Because we know that people who gamble, some of them become addicted. Then you have a lot of bankruptcies and so on. That's awkward for businesses and families in Indiana.
Deciding this case our way does not foreclose a different result in that case because of Pike balancing.
What's the difference?
Because Pike balancing allows courts to take into consideration the strength of the state's interest, which is not the same in that context as it is here.
Well, I think there's strong interest.
States have a long tradition of regulating predatory lending.
I mean, what if Indiana were dry? Could it forbid people to drink alcohol anywhere outside of Indiana?
No, it couldn't. But again, you're not
Why
talking.
Not?
Well, you're not talking about the same kind of state interest. You're not talking about.
Well,
also,
I think it's a very. I think dry states feel they have a, and many religions and so on feel there's a very strong interest in preventing people from drinking.
I'm sure that they do, but the point is that there is a long tradition of states regulating predatory lending, protecting their consumers. That's not
That's not as long as the tradition of dry, right?
Well, the
no
tradition
predatory
of the
lending laws when prohibition was passed.
Well, the tradition of regulating citizens consuming alcohol in other states is not very long. The tradition of regulating interest rates as applied to state citizens, even when the sellers are out of state, is very long. It's much longer. It's exactly what this court upheld in
Alden. When you have a contract in the state, but I'm thinking of a situation where all the conduct occurs out of the state, and yet the state has a substantial interest in its citizens' conduct outside of state.
If we have all of the conduct in another state, it does present a different question. All of the conduct here is not in Illinois. They register their lien on the car through Indiana. They send money by way of checks back to Indiana that may go through Indiana banks. Citizens' cars are repossessed in Indiana, resold in Indiana. The effects are felt in Indiana. There's a whole chain of Indiana contacts here that implicate state interests that just don't arise in other situations where a state might hypothetically try to regulate behavior occurring in another state. And Pike balancing accounts for these kinds of differences. It's exactly the reason that courts put into a balancing test these competing interests of states and
well, I thought your only interest was protecting your citizens. I don't know what the interest has to do with where the car is repossessed.
It has to do with availing the company availing itself of Indiana laws and Indiana protections when it goes to repossess that car. That is activity that occurs in Indiana. It's more intimately related to the state's interest in this case than is where the contract is signed. Where that ink dries doesn't bear nearly as much relationship to the state's interests as does the recording of the lien on the title, the repossession, the resale of the car, and ultimately the effects that are felt, the negative effects that are felt in Indiana communities. Now, we have precedent from cases like Alden's and even Quick
Payday.
Why
does it increase Indiana's interest in the case?
I'm sorry, why does what increase?
Why does the fact that there are these activities in Indiana, the repossession and the registration and so on, and the car itself is there, why does that increase Indiana's interest in the law?
Because they happen in Indiana, and Indiana's trying to...
The interest is based on trying to protect your citizens from these extraordinary interest rates.
That's what happens when those citizens are not protected, are those activities, repossession and resale. That's all part of why we regulate these kinds of transactions. That's part of the whole deal. That contract does not finish when the ink is dried. It continues on into Indiana. There are these remaining effects that we, as a matter of public policy, do not like to have happen, and that justifies our involvement in regulating the relationship. If we look at cases like Quick Payday, for example, there the court, even though there was evidence that the mouse click crossed state lines to complete the contract, that court was very comfortable with the notion that even if the contract had occurred wholly in one state, that the other state could have regulated it. That's exactly the kind of thing we're trying to do here with our extraterritorial provision.
Has Midwest ever had offices in Indiana or...
I'm not aware of any.
...contracts in Indiana or...
I'm sorry, the bank contracts? Is that what you said?
Has it ever actually made contracts that were in Indiana or done by mail or internet or something like that?
Not that I'm aware of.
So,
Counsel, your citizens, residents from Indiana, have the right to go across state lines to different states and transact business. Just because some of those transactions that they freely transact go sour or have consequences, does that give Indiana the right to reach across lines to regulate those?
I think it does, in at least in some context, and that's why pike balancing is so important. Just because we decide here that the regulatory strength is sufficient doesn't mean it is in other cases, and that's all we've argued all along. What's important to bear in mind also is that the per se rule against extraterritorial regulation has only been applied in the context of business protectionism. So even if under a hypothetical situation that seems completely unreasonable, we would still think, as long as we're talking about consumer protection or something other than business protectionism, pike balancing is the test that applies. That's not
what
the
Healy wasn't protectionism.
Oh, yes, it was. It was protecting consumers at the...
No. Talk about protectionism, we mean protecting local business against out-of-state business.
Well, the point in Healy was that it was not traditional consumer protection. It was saying our prices in our state will be guaranteed to be the lowest of any state around here. And that the court equated that with business protectionism. It's the same kind of discriminatory treatment uplifting your state citizens at the expense of other state citizens. That's what the Commerce Clause is designed to protect against. And that's not what this case does. That's not what this kind of regulation does. All this does is it casts a regulatory perimeter around citizens to protect themselves without affecting the citizens of other states.
The standard protectionist move is trying to protect a local industry from foreign competition. And in Healy, there weren't any brewers in Connecticut to be protected.
It was about the consumers. It was about ensuring that consumers paid no higher prices than anywhere else. But the court's point was that it was not traditional consumer protection. It was the point of protecting consumers, yes, but at the expense of citizens and consumers in other states, which is completely different from the kind of consumer protection we're talking about here. That is much more akin to the business protectionist model, where the idea is to reach out in order to protect pure economic interests, not public policy, not police power type interests in the state. It's a very big distinction between that kind of regulation, that sort of price affirmation statute, and just ordinary consumer protection, which is what was affirmed in Alden's and in Quick Payday. And even in CTS, for example, you could very easily, in that case, have a control share acquisition where the ink is signed and dried in New York. But as long as there's a sufficient minimum of Indiana shareholders, that act applies because it's protecting Indiana residents, not at the expense of other residents of other states.
Litigation involving Midwest and Indiana citizens?
No, I'm not aware of any.
General Fisher, let me, if I could, turn to your public policy argument and the balance. As I understand from the briefs, we're talking about roughly a 20% foreclosure.
We have calculated in there. There's a chart at Exhibit B that's has several different 1,500 or so transactions. We've calculated roughly a 10% repossession at least.
So, hard to know what the break point would be to where the policy interest would trigger. But you know, would you say that's high in today's economic times?
I honestly don't know relative to other things.
I don't either.
It seems high to me.
These people, this is an option of kind of last resort.
Yeah.
If they had a paycheck, you in Indiana would allow them to pay an incredible an allowable, horrific rate, right, one of these
At a payday loan? Well, but there the loans are limited to $550, and you can't renew more than five times.
Well, I understand. I don't know whether these car loans go much over $2,500. I'm just trying to put it into context of where this group of individuals.
Well, let's think about the hypothetical transaction we set forth in the brief. If there was a loan of $5,000 and it came in at about, let's say, 372% interest, which is certainly well within the range of what's on that spreadsheet, you're talking about $1,600 a month or $19,400 a year. Now, it strikes me as almost inconceivable that somebody in these dire straits is going to be able to keep up with those payments and to be able to avoid repossession. Now, of course, what happens oftentimes is that these loans get rolled into new loans, and there's just a cycle that goes on so that the consumer tries to avoid repossession that way. But that's exactly what we're trying to avoid in Indiana, is that kind of...
Probably do too much repossession because what are these cars worth? Probably worth very little.
Well, yeah, who knows? But
by the time there.
Bear in mind that the loans are oversecured regardless of the worth of the car because they will loan up to 50% of the value of the car.
The wholesale value.
Well, right? Yes.
Which is even less, obviously.
Right, but the point is that they've always that incentive to repossess exists at the same range because we're always talking about a percentage as opposed to an absolute value of the loan in relation to the value of the car. So, you know, we're talking about fairly draconian terms here, and certainly over-securitization that makes it a pretty difficult deal all the way around for the consumer. So that's why the state has this profound interest that may not exist in other regulatory contexts. Okay, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Just one little question. Wouldn't you achieve much of your goal if you simply forbade their soliciting Indiana and their repossession? Which I don't think would be actually controversial exertions of state power.
Well, I guess I confess I haven't thought through whether that would achieve all the same objectives. I think there's a balancing going on here about to what extent we're going to permit this to go on. Now, the fact of the matter is, under the current regulatory scheme, we don't have title lenders in Indiana.
So you don't have what in Indiana?
We don't have title lenders. We don't have Midwest title type businesses.
Right.
Yeah, so I think the effects are meant to be achieved by way of triggering it with an advertising solicitation, which is normal for consumer protection laws. These laws are normally triggered at the point of solicitation, so that falls in line categorically. Could we achieve exactly the same result with those hypothetical regulations? I confess I haven't thought that through. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Fisher. Mr. Fickle?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to make two points coming out of the immediately preceding argument by Mr. Fisher. He said, I think, three or perhaps four times he mentioned this court's case in Alden's. Alden's involved a Wisconsin credit regulation statute. They are open-ended revolving credit. And it was a statute that did not apply by its terms, as quoted by the court, if the resident of Wisconsin was not in Wisconsin when the transaction was entered into. And this court said, in a footnote 10 in that Alden's case, suppose that many Wisconsin citizens have summer homes in Minnesota. Wisconsin could not regulate Alden's credit terms in mailings to Wisconsin citizens at their Minnesota summer addresses.
I don't think we're dealing with a summer home crowd here.
No, the point is, where was the
Look,
borrower
suppose,
located?
Suppose, this con- suppose you made these contracts with these Indiana people by Internet. Then they could regulate it, couldn't they?
I think that's an open question, Your Honor. In the payday case, the...
I don't think it's open. So what's the difference between that and, you lure these people across the border, right? So, you've got Crown Point on one side, you've got Dyer on the other, you have East Chicago on one side and Chicago on the other. So instead of having an office in Indiana, you say, well, drive across the state line. So as far as the people on the western end of Indiana, northern Indiana is concerned, it looks like kind of the normal way would be to do this by email, and instead, you're to avoid Indiana regulation or strengthen your constitutional argument, you have them come across the border.
With respect, Your Honor, you would never do title lending by email or by mail. You just wouldn't do it.
Why?
Because the way this business works is you've got to get possession of that title, and you have to get the car keys, it's undisputed in this case. It's undisputed in this case. It involves exclusively Indiana residents who leave the state of Indiana, come to Illinois. If a loan transaction is entered into, the terms will be established at the Illinois store, the documents will be executed there, and the loan funds will be dispersed.
Why is that important? I don't understand.
It's important because we have a federal system, and the basis of our federal system is territory, is boundaries. Supreme Court has said this again and again. This court has said it again.
Do you express doubt that Indiana could regulate these transactions if they were by mail or Internet rather than in person?
The rule in the cases would
depend
on where the mail...
I mean, you just said territory. You said territory is a big thing. Now we're talking about a case where, because of the use of the Internet or mail, the transaction occurs, part of it at any rate, half of it, in Indiana. Why isn't that important?
If the borrower is located in Indiana when he enters into the transaction, receives the loan proceeds, it is important. That's
right.
Exactly.
That's
what
I'm saying. That would be an Internet transaction. Yeah.
Well, if the recipient was in Indiana, then yes, I agree with you.
People. So we could have a contract where Midwest sends an email, says, do you want one of these loans? The person says yes, and and Midwest says, okay, we have a deal, we have a contract, but it's conditional on your mailing us your title and your car and a set of car keys. And then, so you're saying if that was how the transaction was handled, then Indiana could regulate it. Is that your position?
And then the loan proceeds were sent to Indiana and received in Indiana. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, that's different. That's what the case law is. That's exactly
the difference
line.
Between that and what they actually do seems awfully trivial.
Well, Your Honor, that's like saying the federal system is trivial. That's like saying it's trivial that...
It's quite like saying...
...equal marijuana on one side of the board.
I don't think it's quite like saying that.
I think is very close to saying that, Your Honor, with respect.
Well, you're taking a very formalistic approach to federalism issues.
Federalism issues are formalistic. The definition
but look,
of states
these
are
Indiana
the
people.
They,
these are Indiana people. They're not Illinoisans. They come across the border to make a deal. Then they go back to Indiana with their car and so on. And it seems to me both Indiana and Illinois have an interest here. But let me ask you this. Could
with respect, Your Honor, Commerce Clause cases are not decided based on whether a state has an interest or not.
Well, it's certainly relevant.
It is relevant in some circumstances, yes. But it is not relevant in the extraterritoriality
cases. Yeah, but you're not
cases.
Giving a reason, right? You're not giving a reasoned response. You're just saying this is, you know, this federal system and territory is terribly important. If you can lure some across state lines, it can do anything. You know, the person's state loses all regulatory authority. Look, could Indiana just say no? That automobiles in Indiana cannot be security for a loan?
Across the board, yes. It could.
And they could say all title loans are non-recourse. They could say that.
All title loans, yes. They could say that. Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't have to be title, just titles to cars.
But, Your Honor, when we're talking about regulation, extraterritorial regulation of commerce.
They could
commerce,
say, for example,
you have to look at
they could say, couldn't they, that no auto loan can be non-recourse. No auto loan can be a recourse loan if the interest rate exceeds X percent. Could do that.
Yes, it could.
They can actually do most of what they want to do. In a way that you wouldn't regard as unconstitutional.
Right.
Are you sure
but
about that, Mr.
Well, not if they go across state lines.
Across state lines. No, they would apply to all title loans, all car loans in Indiana. They just say, for any car loan in Indiana, they're non-recourse if the interest rate is higher than X. Right? No problem.
Respect, Your Honor, what do we mean by in Indiana? What's the definition of in Indiana in your hypothetical?
Well, they say no automobile in Indiana, no automobile registered in Indiana may be the subject of a recourse loan if the interest rate on the loan exceeds a particular amount.
That's a tough one for me, Your Honor.
Wait a second. Would that preclude GMAC or Ford Finance from operating in Indiana if that was the statutory imposition by the legislature?
Well, I think the hypothetical was if your interest rate's higher than a certain amount.
Well, it's X. I thought it was X. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't. Let's say the interest rate is 25%. You're saying that might pass muster. You could interfere with the commerce of the nationwide auto finance operation.
Well, I mean, in that case, you're going to if it's really not truly extraterritorial. I mean, if it's transacted in part in Indiana, then you're going to get
into
pipe
penalty. Look, in a number of states like California, residential mortgage loans are non-recourse. Period. It doesn't matter where the transaction took place or anything. Right.
As a
just
practical
cannot
matter,
bring a deficiency. Cannot bring a deficiency judgment for a mortgage default in California. Right. So you can have the same provision involving automobiles in Indiana. Right.
Yes, Ryan. As a practical matter, these are non-recourse. I mean, you can see in the amicus brief. You can see from the stipulation, Midwest Title has never brought an action for a deficiency judgment. As a practical matter. Given the nature of this industry, these are non-recourse loans, even whether or not they're written like that.
So, right. The people have no money, obviously. After they've paid some of your interest, they don't have any money to satisfy a judgment.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, if a high rate that's paid off the following week or even the following month involves a relatively small amount of dollars. But one additional point I want to make.
Well, if they pay it, of course, you don't sue them. So.
We don't sue them, period. That's a stipulation. It's undisputed.
They don't have enough to be worth suing.
Correct. But I need to make the point that this particular mode of regulation here does not only set the terms of the transaction. What it says is, of course, if you advertise in Indiana, that's a trigger, that an Illinois business cannot do business with an Indiana resident who walks into the Illinois store without coming to Indiana, applying for a loan license, which subjects the lender to plenary regulation in Indiana, and the Indiana regulatory authorities decide to grant it.
So also, isn't Indiana applying the law equally to Indiana businesses and Illinois businesses? They're not favoring one over another, are they?
Your Honor, I think that's going to be true in every extraterritorial case. That's why we have an extraterritorial doctrine. The treatment may be equal, but the jurisdiction of the state legislature, is bounded in our federal system.
And so isn't Midwest utilizing Indiana's state facilities relating to the loan, such as getting a lien by the Secretary of State?
Yes, Your Honor, but you have to look at what's being regulated. What is the thing being regulated? In this case, what's being regulated is not the lien process, for example, or the use of Indiana's roads. What's being regulated in this case is the establishment of the terms of the transaction, and that is what occurs exclusively in Illinois, can only occur in Illinois.
It's so formalistic. I mean, the contract may be signed in Illinois, but as Judge Duryagin was saying, you know, a lot happens in Indiana because that's where the car is. And if there's repossession, it's going to occur in Indiana, and Indiana police will protect the repossessor against the furious car owner. So there's an Indiana involvement in these transactions, obviously.
And in every extraterritorial regulation case.
Not many extraterritorial regulation cases, are there?
There are not many because states haven't often tried to do this sort of thing. But the ones we have, by definition, Your Honor,
Your best case?
We like Dean Foods very well. We like the footnote in Alden's very well. We like Healy very well. We like Brown-Forman very well. We like the Bigelow case. The Bigelow case is excellent.
I don't understand. I don't think Healy is really on point because in Healy, the state regulation would affect transactions between brewers in other states and drinkers in other states. So it really had an extraterritorial impact. But how does this law affect Midwest's dealing with people in Illinois? Illinois, it doesn't affect them.
It's not
affecting people outside the state.
But, Your Honor, Healy is a tougher case than this because in Healy,
Look, suppose Midwest just had Indiana customers. It had no customers in any other state. It had just perched across the state line regarding Hoosiers as particularly good customers for such loans. And then would you make the same argument that Indiana couldn't regulate an activity which was in fact wholly aimed at Indiana and just the location of the seller was somewhere else? Would you still make that argument?
But the Indiana resident had to leave Indiana?
Would you still make that argument?
On the facts of this case, yes, Your Honor. Well, if the Indiana resident leaves Indiana...
It's just such a facile evasion of state regulation. Here you have a company, if it moved, 50 feet to the east, it would be fully subject to Indiana regulation, but because it moved its business 50 feet west, it can do anything it wants. And Illinois doesn't care because it has no Illinois customers, right? So wouldn't that be a problem with the federal system?
There's a solution in the federal system if that is a problem, and it doesn't lie
Indiana or Illinois. Problem. Now, why isn't it a problem in my hypothetical case?
It may be a problem, Your Honor. I mean, that's, of course, hypothetical. It's not this case. We're talking 10%.
Oh, it's not this case? You mean I made some terrible misunderstanding when I asked you a hypothetical question? I really thought it was a real question about this case. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying in this case, Your Honor.
No, I'm talking about my hypothetical case, which is not this case. Otherwise, it wouldn't be hypothetical, right?
Okay.
So in that case, we have a firm. It used to be in Indiana. Indiana tries to shut it down with this law, so it moves 50 feet west into Illinois. Has no Illinois customers, contacts, shareholders, employees, anything. And it's in its old business. It's just dealing with the Indiana people. And so, but you're saying still Indiana could not regulate it as long as the contract was signed in Illinois.
As long as the Indiana resident left Indiana, entered the state of Illinois, and
well,
did
I
the transaction.
Well, I just said that. I mean, that's the example, obviously, right? If the contract is signed in Illinois, all right, so if the Indiana person walks 50 feet and signs it in Illinois, then in your view, that would be beyond, and that would be outside of Indiana's regulatory power.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is the nature of the federal system in the 50 states.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Fickle. And Mr. Fisher, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. The point came up that there are not many extraterritorial cases, and I think that that's a very important point because those cases really are in a unique category. And in fact, Dean...
Well, how is the Dean Foods case different?
Well, it's different because, again, it's economic...
That's their principle.
Right. It's economic protectionism. It's protecting the small farmers in Wisconsin. It's not consumer protection. And in fact, in Alliant Energy, the case that came after Dean Foods, the court did not apply the extraterritoriality doctrine. It applied pike balancing. And that was a situation where Wisconsin was requiring incorporation in Wisconsin of a company that wanted to incorporate elsewhere but still be a public service.
Fisher, there's no question at a baseline we're affecting commerce here, right?
Yes.
And how widespread does the problem have to be for the state of Indiana to exercise this public policy? I mean, you don't have this problem in Evansville, I assume. You've got a unique situation of a population that identifies itself economically with Illinois for a whole host of reasons.
Right.
Tobacco, you know,
right.
You and I know very well, General, the traffic. So now, is this a decision by Indiana to focus on a limited number of individuals who are contiguous to another state and impact the commerce of that state, at least in this limited area, in a significant way? As a percentage of your entire population, I understand you want to protect all the citizens, General, but I'm just saying, is this kind of a targeted extraterritorial move by the state?
That gets well beyond my knowledge. I don't think so. I think what we've got is that you've got a generally applicable law in the IUCCC, and then you've got a provision that says this applies if there's a solicitation coming in from out of state. That is a generally applicable provision. It's neutral with respect to geography, and it doesn't fall trapped to any of the general purposeful discrimination kinds of laws.
Well,
that
I'm thinking about what Judge Boser was talking about. I mean, are you worried about the Kentucky draw on gambling for your residents in southern Indiana so they don't fall astray?
I think it goes back to the strength of the interest, not so much the volume, but the strength of the overall interest in whether Evansville citizens are going to...
Well, but the strength of the interest is really a difficult thing to grasp. Health, consumer protection. I mean, you know, when you break it out, it's very little that the state doesn't want to protect, and it's parental approach. I appreciate that. But I'm just trying to see whether in this balancing, whether we ought to look, whether we have a significant statewide interest affecting a significant number of individuals, which would cause us to look at the Commerce Clause in a way that, you know, we're sometimes reluctant to do.
I see my time's up. If I may have a short response. The benefit that we have here is that we have a long line of cases saying that the state has a compelling interest in usury caps. That's nothing new. There's no new law to be created there, so you're not opening the door to other unknown types of regulations. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Fisher and Mr. Fickle.